I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the Barbershop Guys give the thumbs up or down to two heavyweights making big moves this week, President Obama and LeBron James. We hope you're intrigued. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about the week's news with the loyal opposition. We turn now to our conservative voices. Joining me is Matthew Continetti, an associate editor at the Weekly Standard. Also with us is Raihan Salam, a fellow at the New America Foundation and co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Let's pick up where our last conversation left off. We were talking about General Motors. I want to play a short clip of Vice President Cheney, former Vice President Cheney. Sometimes it's easy to forget. We've heard so much of him lately. Speaking with Fox News Channel about President Bush's handling of General Motors. Here it is.
He felt, you know, these are big issues, and he wouldn't be there through the process of managing it. But in effect would have sort of pulled the plug on GM, and that was one of the first crises the new administration would have to deal with. So he put together a package that tied a GM over until the new administration had a chance to look at it, decide what they wanted to do.
Matthew, let me go to you first. President Obama has repeatedly talked about how he's inherited problems from the Bush administration. In a way, it does seem as though Vice President Cheney is saying that the Bush administration deliberately kicked the can down the road in order to force Obama to deal with this. Do you see it that way?
Well, he actually put, the way Cheney described it, it seemed like he was doing the Obama administration a favor because they didn't want the Obama administration to inherit a GM in liquidation. Look, GM and Chrysler's problems stretch far beyond both the Obama and Bush administrations. They go back decades. What strikes me about this is, you know, we know the national security state. People give up a certain degree of individual liberty in order to be protected from threats. We live in a welfare state where there are certain obligations imposed on all of us in the form of taxes and duties in exchange for basic social benefits. Well, now we're in the bailout state. And in the bailout state, politically connected groups are able to obtain not just government support, which we've seen in the cases of the agriculture, railroad, and steel industries, but direct government ownership and control of certain sectors of the economy. We see it with the government-sponsored entities, which were always slightly entangled with government, Fannie and Freddie. We see it now with the financial sector, and now it's the auto sector. And this introduces so many distortions and complications. It's going to be a problem for Obama and the Democrats for a long time to come.
But couldn't one argue that part of the reason that the Bush administration acted as it did was to avoid making it a problem for the Republicans?
Well,
because they would have done the same thing and didn't want to have to.
No one wants to inherit. The basic intellectual assumption of the bailout state is that you need to take direct ownership and control of these industries and these companies in order to maintain overall economic stability. I think in the case of the TARP back in September, that was reasonable. I was persuaded by that. But now we see how difficult it is to extract ourselves from these industries. And it's something that Obama's going to find as well. And what he's also going to find is that these industries can be used as instruments of social and economic policy. Tell the banks to lend. Tell Fannie and Freddie to keep giving mortgages to people who might not otherwise qualify, and turn the automakers into green car manufacturers.
Raihan, I do want to hear what you have to say about this, but I so want to get to your comments about Sonia Sotomayor. I'm hoping, is it okay with you that we just go right to
sure.
that? Because you wrote about that this week. And as we've just discussed, a number of conservatives have blasted Sonia Sotomayor. Some party bigwigs like Rush Limbaugh, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich went so far as to call her a racist. Now, former Speaker Gingrich has walked those comments back, saying that he went too far in that case. I get the sense that this whole thing is driving you a little bit crazy. You wrote a piece about this recently for Forbes.com where you call this whole thing a sideshow. Tell me more about what you think about this.
Well, basically, I think that one thing that happens when a party is in opposition, when a party is in the minority, is that you see a breakdown of discipline. And you see a lot of figures who make their living as commentators. They don't necessarily wield power. And so there's an obligation to say something that's salacious and interesting that grabs you by the lapels. And so I think that when you're looking at the Republican mainstream, I think a lot of people feel that, well, Sonia Sotomayor is a liberal who is replacing a liberal. And basically there's, you know, something at stake. She's quite a bit younger. And there's a lot of uncertainty regarding her views on national security issues, other salient issues. But fundamentally, this is not something where it's appropriate to go nuclear. That's what John Cornyn, you know, who actually is on the Judiciary Committee, believes. And yet you have someone like Tom Tancredo, who, lest we forget, received a tiny, tiny amount of support in an actual Republican presidential primary, who speaks for hardly anyone other than Tom Tancredo, who can barely get served in a restaurant in the state of Colorado, whether that restaurant is owned by Republicans or Democrats. And he's someone who has been made into a spokesperson for the Republican mainstream, which is simply bizarre. And I think it's a kind of trap because, you know, it's not that it's deliberately done by media organizations, because everyone wants to hear someone interesting and someone who's going to call Sonia Sotomayor, who again seems fairly boring, frankly, a crazy racist, is just going to attract more attention. It's very frustrating to watch.
Mm. Matt, are you dying to weigh in on this, or shall we move on to the president's speech in Cairo?
Well, it does strike me, the more I learn about Sonia Sotomayor, the more I see why Obama picked her. Mm-hmm. And it's because they share very similar profiles. The Washington Post has a great story today going through these documents, going through these speeches. That comment, the infamous comment she made about a wise Latina judge judging better than a white male judge, that's something she had used in a different formulation in 1994. This is something very important to her. And I think that's one thing she shares with Obama, the sense of personal narrative, personal experiences shaping entire worldviews. And we see that in Obama's Cairo speech. Another thing they share, they're both urban people. Sonia Sotomayor in her speeches talks about being from a New Yorker. You know, she has a funny line where she says, for me as a New Yorker, 7 a.m. isn't when you start the day, it's when you finish the last one.
And the third, is that so terrible?
No, not at all.
Is that disqualifying?
I went to school in New York. Okay. I love New Yorker. I'm describing these two candidates, mm-hmm. the two people, how they share values. The third thing that they share is they're actually a lot less liberal than they sound. You know, it's fascinating. You hear some of the Sotomayor talk about how important her ethnicity is to her, how important diversity is. But then, as Chris Hayes was pointing out in the earlier segment, you look at some of her rulings. She's siding with the prosecution. On business,
she's a former prosecutor.
She's a former prosecutor, and it's still okay. So maybe mm-hmm. her experiences are shaping her there, but she's still on the side of law and order in these decisions. She's still on the side of business in a lot of decisions. Just like how Obama, even though he drives conservatives crazy with some of his rhetoric, he actually governs relatively toward the center.
Okay, and finally, we do want to spend some time on the president's address to the Muslim world from Cairo. The president talked about rebooting the relationship. So I want to ask each of you, in the time we have left, was this a necessary speech, Raihan? Was this a useful speech?
Well, I think that it was a worthwhile gesture, but the problem is when you want to have a conversation with the Muslim world, you need to have a party on the other side who's willing to engage in a conversation. And I think that it's very admirable that President Obama was trying to frame things in such a way that an honest and sympathetic interlocutor on the other side who's willing to kind of understand American motivations, you know, could understand and sympathize. I think the trouble is, and this is something that President Obama doesn't have much control over, when you're looking at Publix in the Muslim Middle East, I think there's a real profound unwillingness to acknowledge that maybe they don't have a full understanding of America. America is a very big, powerful cultural presence around the world. And so a lot of folks outside of America believe we know everything we need to know about that country, and you can say what you will, but you know, we know that it's an imperialist power, et cetera. And I think the real problem is that there isn't a level of openness on the other side of this conversation.
Well, how do you start that if you don't start that?
It's not clear that making this kind of gesture is what it takes, honestly. I think that it's something that has to happen internally over there. So again, I think that it was a worthwhile gesture, but it's not clear to me that it's going to work.
Matthew, your thoughts?
I think when you look at the various audiences, and of course there's so many audiences to this speech, the reaction we're getting from citizens in the Middle East, in the broader Muslim world, they seem to have really admired this speech. I'm looking at the reaction from a different audience. The audience is in the capitals of the countries, in the actual real world of geopolitics. I'm not seeing much change at all. Two governments in particular, Iran, even before the speech, Ayatollah Khamenei said, it's just words, doesn't matter. And the Iranian satellites, Hezbollah and Hamas, which are the two real obstacles to any final settlement, they both too said, doesn't matter what he says. The second government mm-hmm. that's important is the Israeli government. And I think the message they're going to draw from this speech is Obama is serious about cracking down on us. He is serious about stopping these settlements. And he's also serious about having action this year on a Middle East peace process. To me, that's hubris. Hmm.
Matthew Continetti is an associate editor at the Weekly Standard. Raihan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and the co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. They were both kind enough to join us from our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.